Welcome to Theatre Voice. I'm at the Soho Theatre, not in the theatre, but in an office upstairs, but it's a bit of a powerhouse out there. And I'm with a powerhouse, actually, because I'm with Opera Up Close's Agnes Beverley Mars. Artistic director, more than that, I think, can't you, Adam?
I founded Opera Up Close in 2009, and I was the founding artistic director. And I'm now the artistic director of the King's Head Theatre, and I work as an associate director of Opera Up Close now. And it's now led by the wonderful woman, Robin Norton-Hale, who was the director of our La Boheme.
From that I glean at least that you have to have a double-barreled name in order to run Opera Up Close, I should think.
You don't have to have one, but it helps.
Anyway, welcome to Theatre Voice, to you, Adam, and Demelza Stafford, actually a.k.a. Tosca in this particular case. So welcome, Demelza.
Thank you very much.
Does that mean you're Cornish?
No, I'm not Cornish. No, I was named after the lovely Anne Carradrice, who played Demelza in the Poldark series. Oh, right. So yes. It's turned into a very helpful name working in opera.
It's a good name. It's a good operatic name.
Thank you.
It was a good operatic thought, this idea of opera up close. So up close that it's all one word, which I absolutely love. Was your idea, Adam, then, to get closer to the audience, or was it to bring in people who might be put off by all the trappings of opera, not least of which is the price, I suppose?
Both, and probably a lot more. I think that the whole mission statement of Opera Up Close is to remove a lot of preconceived barriers that audiences might have about the art form itself, but also to allow audiences to get a lot closer, not physically, but also metaphysically and abstractly get closer to the art form. So by singing it in a new English translation, by having more reasonable ticket prices, a different dress code, singers the right age to play the roles, that is a way to get closer to the art form, as well as a physical proximity as well. Because often when you go to the Royal Opera House, the wonderful Royal Opera House, the closest seat is still further away than our furthest seat.
Well, because you've got the pit between you and the stage, and you don't exactly have a pit either, do you?
No. Some people see a large orchestra as a barrier. In fact, a lot of conductors acknowledge that when they're working with very large orchestras, sometimes the conductor's ideas can be suffocated by certain sections of the orchestra in certain sections of the opera, which isn't to say that I don't think that big, large-scale opera is wonderful, but in this particular form of opera, we try to reveal the composer's raw, essential, bare ideas, and that's often done with perhaps using a trio of instruments or maybe even just a piano in the case of La Boheme.
I've seen La Boheme with just a piano, which I thought was rather wonderful because it sort of felt like a street piano, you might actually find in the streets. And I've just seen Tosca now with the three instruments, which are, let's get it right, cello, clarinet and piano. Have I got that right?
That's right, yeah. We use two clarinets and cello and piano. And it captures really interestingly, it gets everything in, really does. I mean, at some points you do miss the percussion, but when you do a kind of full assessment of the piece, what you lose in those moments, you gain by being able to present opera in such a new, exciting, accessible way.
Demelza, I presume you've experienced singing opera on a grand opera, as we probably could call it, on a big stage with an orchestra and all the rest of it and a chorus. If you have, how does that yes?
Yes, not on huge stages yet, but yes, with full orchestras. And it is a very different experience. There's a lovely relationship between the ensemble and the singers in this production. Even in the dressing room, we get to talk about things in a much more intimate way and discuss various feelings about what's happening musically. And we can make choices together and discuss them. It's a really intimate way to work, and it's very special.
How about that proximity to the audience? How does that feel?
It's always an interesting thing. It's exciting because it's nice to feel... when I originally started singing on stages, what I enjoyed was to be quite a distance from the audience and to feel like I was in my own world. And the difference now is that I've learned that actually what I benefit most from is inviting the audience into that world of my own. And they're so close here that they're almost literally standing on my feet at times. And it means that the very intimate psychological drama is shared in a real way, and that they can't escape the same situations that I'm stuck in dramatically, and the suffering that I experience, they have to share with me on a very intimate level, which is a lot to ask from an audience, but it's a big thing for them to experience, and something that they hopefully will, even when they're watching a bigger opera on a bigger stage, be able to connect with that feeling again, and experience that grand opera in a more intimate way, because they know what it feels like to be that singer in that space. So it's a lovely experience.
Right, okay, so it might be daunting to start with, but you realise how lovely it all is. Let's talk about Tosca, but if we talk about Tosca, we're sort of still referring to the other operas, really. I mean, we can, and we should just say, shouldn't we, that de Meltzer has played the lead, Million in the Girl of the Golden West. Oh, Chula del West, I love saying that. It sounds so totally bizarre. And now you're playing Tosca, Floria Tosca, which is just the most wonderful, iconic part. So there are shoes to fill, but I think it must be very different filling them here, as we said.
It is, yes, because I'm given a freedom here that potentially on a grander stage I wouldn't have. I don't necessarily need to make something communicate to a room that holds thousands of people, which means I can make more intimate decisions than I would necessarily have in a bigger space. So yes, they are very big shoes to fill, but it lets you explore a different part to Tosca than most people get the opportunity to.
Yeah, well, which is fantastic. And so, Adam, I don't know how you do all this. You write the libretto, these wonderful librettos, which is worth doing because we actually get to hear the words, because frankly, even if opera's sung in English, sometimes you can't really hear what's being said, and there will still be surtitles. You don't really need them, do you?
One of the things about Opera Up Close is that we commission a new translation for every new production, which is great because it means that we don't have to use someone else's translation and shoehorn it, if you like, into the way that we do opera, which is in usually untraditional spaces. So it means that each libretto fits the production like a glove. And it's great because the director usually writes it or is involved heavily in the writing of the libretto, which means that the story is already starting to be told before rehearsals even start, so that when the director meets with the musical director and the cast, they're able to go on a real journey of process in terms of making the work, rather than just chessboard opera directing, which is, you know, working on a large stage and being told take two steps down and one to the left kind of thing. Is that we can actually spend 3 or 4 weeks together as a company doing what's not very usual in the opera world, but going through a big rehearsal process where the artists that we work with get a real deep, rich understanding of the piece. And it's all being made by the group of artists in the room rather than using a translation that was from the 50s, for example.
And if you find, if one of the singers finds that something doesn't work, you will change it, will you?
Often. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about writing a libretto, is that essentially the ideas don't change. But, I mean, de Meltzer will probably attest to this, is that she will come into rehearsal and say, do you know what, I think this would work a little bit better. And what she's talking about really is technically, as a singer, vowel modulation, and, you know, I can sing this better on this note kind of thing. But in that sense, it is a collaboration.
Is it nice to have that collaboration then, de Meltzer? I mean, you've made suggestions.
Yes, it is nice. It's nice to know that there can be moments where a particular vowel sound can allow me to make a certain colour depending on how the drama's going. So it means we can discuss things and really explore the colours that we can make, almost especially because we don't have such an enormous orchestra. It means that the colours are even more important than they would be anywhere else. So to be able to work with the libretto and discuss things is really nice.
I just want to talk about very specifically Tosca. The other thing that you have the freedom to do, well, I suppose everybody does, don't they? I mean, Jonathan Miller's been doing it for ages, moving the Mikado into Sergius country houses and all that sort of thing. It all seems to work brilliantly. But I was so excited when I saw that you'd moved the story of Tosca, Floria Tosca, the opera diva and her revolutionary artist lover Cavaradossi, and Scarpia, the unscrupulous police chief who has the power of life and death over Cavaradossi when he arrests him and aims to use that to blackmail Tosca or to bed Tosca. You've relocated that story to the East Berlin of 1989. the Berlin of the Stasi just as the wall was about to come tumbling down. And it's the time of that film, The Lives of Others, which is the most stunning film. And I gather that that it did influence you. I mean, it was something that you're paying some sort of tribute to, isn't it?
Yeah, in a way. I mean, it's no secret that I watched that film and thought, wow, that's how I want to do my Tosca. But actually, in a way, I would be very surprised if the screenwriter of The Lives of Others didn't watch Tosca first and then actually take the archetypal design of Tosca, which isn't even Puccini's, it's Victorian Sardou's. Actually, it's his five-act verbose play that Puccini saw, and then the screenwriter for The Lives of Others saw Tosca and then did his film, and then I saw his film and said, well, I'm doing a Tosca, so I might just take it all and mix it all together. But yeah, it is very much a period in time of modern history that doesn't seem to be covered that much in the history books yet. So I thought it'd be a wonderful opportunity to maybe start that revolution of looking at that period of the 50s up until 1989, when the Soviet Union was in existence, but specifically the split Germany.
Yeah, but we're very much on the eve of it not being split, and so we the audience, we know what's going to happen next. It's like watching a Second World War film. You have to keep telling yourself they didn't know that it was going to end in 1945 in unallied victory, did they?
Well, that's one of the most important things in rehearsals, is that we need to say to, you know, the guys playing in the Stasi, you woke up this morning thinking that tomorrow was going to be a normal day. You know, let's not have a premonition here. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. But now, how does that feel to you, Demelz? I mean, this relocation in time and place.
It's quite an exciting one, to be honest, because you know that it's a very real situation, and one that, okay, it was too early for me to remember, but a lot of the people that will be here to see will remember the political tension, and they'll remember the situations and the images that they saw coming out at the time. And it's something that then means it's totally relatable. And when I speak to people and they say, oh, I've never seen an opera, and you say, well, first off, it's Tosca, it's the most incredible music ever. Secondly, it's moved into this time period and it's in English. It's something you're going to understand as a world. Before we even start, you already know the world that we're working in. You'll recognise the things, and you'll recognise how trapped people are within the colour schemes of things. Even there's the whole world is blocked in a particular way, and seeing how a character like Tosca is so important in that world, how different she is to everything else, because nothing else around her is as flamboyant as she is. So it helps to understand her appeal to the men in the opera as well. You know, she's, I think, in a time where everything was much grander, when we see it on a grand stage, you kind of, to some extent, wonder why anyone would be so interested in this character. She is flamboyant. She's an amazing opera singer, but she's not, you know, she's not that different, you would have thought. Whereas in this world, you really see that she offers an entirely different world to the men around her, and that's why she becomes a focus for them and why she finds herself in this terrible position.
Actually brought up a very interesting point, that it is only men around her, isn't it? I mean, there are no other women in this opera.
No, there's no women. She's the only woman in a world of men.
So Puccini, I don't know whether he was like the Noel Coward thing about the potency of cheap music in his day, I'm not quite sure, except that I know he knows how to press buttons. I know that you do a lot of Puccini. I mean, we've talked about it, at least three. You only have to sing certain phrases, to say, Mimi, and then that if you sing Visidate, I challenge anyone not to cry. I mean, I think that works fantastically in the intimacy that you create. Is that one of the reasons why you go for Puccini? Because it's like a pumping good story with an awful lot of emotion in the music.
Yeah, I think Puccini fits my treatment of opera better than earlier periods in music. And it's because we're talking about the style of opera, if you like, in that you don't get huge sections of repetition of dialogue. And usually that's because Puccini has found a play and then written about it. And so you get something that moves just quickly. It just moves on and on and on and on and on. That style's called a verismo style, which means that we talk about naturalism and realism, so the kind of acting style that you'd see on a West End stage of a play, for example. And that's the same for Bizet as well. And, you know, the kind of Puccini and all of his contemporaries were writing in that verismo style. And it's a certain opera where, as opposed to Donizetti or Mozart, where things just go around and around and around and around in circles, where you say the same thing 100 times. Mm. With Puccini, you get it once, and that's it, we're moving on, kind of thing, which suits my work so well, because I'm a theatre director primarily, and I'm a text-based theatre director who happened to train as an opera singer who loves opera. So I kind of bring those two things together.
Of course, verismo is going to really work with this, as you've said, very frighteningly uniformed period where you've got, you know, everybody being under threat. What I mean is it fits like a glove into this dreary, terrifying world, the world of the stars.
Yeah, I mean, what Puccini's music has allowed us to do with this production is take time to tell stories, not just through the libretto and through the singing, but also through a visual language. So we're able to really celebrate the delicious detail of that period where if you were found with a Coke bottle, for example, you could be thrown in prison, or radio stations... those only specific radio stations that you could listen to from the East, so we can delineate those radio stations on an actual radio player for Scarpia to interrogate. Or in the case where Cavadossi's being interrogated by Scarpia, we can put a scent pad on the seat, and so his hands have to go down under his thighs when he sits down. And then there's a beautiful passage of music where Scarpia can remove that scent pad and put it into a scent specimen jar and categorize it, and all of these lovely, delicious things that this period allows us to do. And because of the style of the opera, we get these passages of music where we're allowed to tell stories visually, which are sometimes traditionally reserved for what's called crossing the La Scala stage, which basically is we need 30 seconds of music so that Tosca can leave the massive stage. But when we're working on the much smaller version of the La Scala stage, which is the Soho Theatre, we can use it to explore other ideas that this adaptation of ours has presented with us.
In other words, drama. It's almost like having a screen, a small screen, isn't it? That we're watching it in huge detail. There's close-ups, that's what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, that's what this form of opera allows you to do, is that you don't need to work in broad brushstrokes or broad gestures. You don't have to deal with stereotype, because you are sometimes as close as you are sitting to me now. And so it's more cinematic, if you like.
That's exactly what I meant.
Yeah, there's less about having to broadcast things very far. It can be quite introverted, and that's a lovely thing for an audience to see. It's just how brilliant opera singers are at acting, and also for the opera singers to also be able to explore a style of performance that doesn't usually exist when you're working on mid to large scale opera.
Now, some of the cheeky things that you've done, every critic of course has mentioned, you actually let someone sing the Red Flag. I think it's absolutely wonderful. Are there a couple of other things that you can think of in the translation where you've been absolutely wonderfully cheeky and it's really, really worked?
I think it's important that you allow yourself as an artist to do that, because really that's why theatre is made. It's an ephemeral art form, and any composer or playwright that makes a new piece of theatre knows that after the original performance it is going to be reinterpreted, and it's absolutely ridiculous for any critic to think otherwise. That's why people like Puccini and Verdi oversaw translations in their own lifetime, to make sure that it would be accessible in different ways to different populations. So in addition to taking out the Angelus, which would be ridiculous to have in this production, and replace it with the Red Flag, is we've changed the Madonna to Honecker.
That was a great moment.
Thank you. And instead of Scarpia listening to terrible dancers outside his office in Act Two, he's listening to a terrible pianist, which always gets a nice laugh from the audience each night, as our pianist Elspeth looks up with eyes that could kill.
Funnily enough, that was actually one of the most important things I need to mention. Whilst we're talking about the musicians, we, the audience, really do connect with them, and I think they connect with us. And I'm assuming that for you, De Meltzer, it must be fantastic to have that proximity, and the fact that there is only three or four of them.
Yes, yes it is. And like I say, there are special moments that myself and the cellist or the clarinetist in particular, because they're more used to playing in a larger ensemble, whereas the pianists are quite used to working one-on-one with singers and having a close decision process. It's really lovely that we can speak afterwards, and you know, often the cellist will say, oh, it breaks my heart, that line, I just love when we do that together, and it sounds like this and it feels like this to me, and I always know you want more space there. Mm. And the experience is entirely shared, because they are a part of my sound. It is, my sounds are created around theirs, and I would make different sounds if I were with a big orchestra. So we all contribute to each other's sound world, and it's really exceptional to have an opportunity to work like that and to have a conversation as well with them. You know, we share a dressing room, whereas quite often you and the orchestra are in two separate areas of a theatre and you never get to talk to each other even.
Which is absolutely ridiculous. Yeah. Because they are artists working together, and it's ridiculous to think that they should just come on stage in front of an audience and have a chemistry and a kind of way of working together if they haven't actually worked together. Whereas when we work in opera up close in this way, we get everyone together. We get the musicians come into rehearsals as early as possible. We don't wait. And so the singers can say, look, this is an ensemble piece, and the musicians and the singers are the ensemble, and there's no conductor leading from the front. It needs to be like two lovers that know that if I touch you there, you need to do this, and I know you like this, so I'm going to do this, and if one day I touch you there, maybe you'll respond like this. It's really alive, really.
The set, this particular one, very, very simple, because it can be. Is that important to you as well, though?
Yeah, my original set designer, Nina Franson, and I took a week-long recce to Berlin, and we stayed with somebody who was in the East Berlin Army from 1986 until 1989. So he was able to take us around to a lot of fantastic museums, the Stasi prison, show us a lot of the architecture, tell us a lot of stories. And actually, the colour scheme that we've used is actually a replication of the Stasi prison and the interrogation rooms. The base of the wall, the wall's cut into two parts with a very awkward dado line running through it, and the bottom is a very ugly, dirty mustard, and the top is a kind of grey cream, and it's split straight through the horizontal middle with a red pinstripe.
So it's pretty close to the original then, and pretty horrible, pretty scary to be in.
Yeah, and we've in this production at the Soho Theatre, we've also got vinyl tiles on the floor as well that are a cream colour and a really disgusting mission brown, and they don't quite fit together, but they look gorgeous.
Oh, they look the business, all right.
And also the design of the desks as well, the way they sit together perpendicular to each other, is also a copy of the actual interrogation rooms that anybody can go and look at the Stasi prison and Stasi Museum in Berlin.
Because it is an opera in which torture takes place. I mean, you actually do there. I think there are notes, aren't there, when Cavaradossi is actually being tortured. So that's why it fits like a glove. And it's so scary up close.
Yes, it is. And because the kind of torture was a psychological one, it works incredibly well in this, and it's less ridiculous to just hear screams coming off stage. Mm. You sit there and you realise that it's the mental torture of Tosca, not of Cavaradossi, which is actually the fact in the original, but it's less obvious. This time you know it's her that's being tortured. You know that it's entirely a mental bullying that makes her give way and at exactly the wrong moment in time give up the secrets that if she kept for an extra hour, everyone would end this alive. You know, it's tragic.
So finally, what next for Opera Up Close?
Opera Up Close is doing a new opera, which was the winner of our Flourish New Opera competition last year, which is Two Caravans, which is going to be on in October. And then Robin Norton Hale is directing La Traviata, and then Robert Chavara is directing a Christmas production of Die Fledermaus.
Well, thank you both very much indeed, Adam and Meltzer. And more power to the collective elbows, because there are several of them, aren't there, of
sure
Opera
is.
Up Close.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.